Welcome to Modern Practice. I'm your host, Dr. Tom Villanueva, Principal for Operations and Quality at Vizient and Practicing Internist. Joining in the podcast are my returning guests, Dr. Maddie McDowell, Senior Principal for Intelligence at Vizient, and Dr. Marty Lucenti, Senior Vice President and Chief Medical Officer for Solution Architecture at Vizient. Maddie, Marty, really glad that you're back. So what have we learned about mass closures? Do they work? Did they work?
I'm sure Marty and I are going to disagree on this one, which is good, right? People really criticize the mass closures when looking back at them. But what we have to remember is they bought us time. And that was the goal of them because we did not understand the nature of COVID in so many ways. We had such little information. We had about 8 weeks of information on COVID. And we saw our hospitals in New York become just overwrought with the demand for care and unnecessarily high mortality rate. And so the mass closures were an attempt to press the pause button to figure out what's going on. Now, in hindsight, all of us could say we should have done mass closures based on prevalence, right? Like we weren't going to stop this thing from coming into our country with travel restrictions. We knew it was going to go through our country at a different pace over time. And so in looking back, the way you would have planned for mass closures is based on prevalence. So again, we had no testing in March, remember? So we had no prevalence rates. So it's very easy to go back and say we did it wrong, but that did press the pause button so we could get testing, so we could better understand where the disease was and when it was going to peak.
Marty, I know you have some thoughts as well.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it all starts with a clarity of your strategy from a public health approach. And we've had challenges on being declarative about our strategy. And so when you are not declarative about your overarching strategy, it's hard to judge each of the individual pieces. If you ask me if mass closures are an important part of a zero tolerance, a society that took a zero tolerance approach, yes, they're very important. And you can see some of those strategies. You see them in Southeast Asia. You even saw it in New Zealand, Australia. They were incredibly effective.
New Zealand had 25 deaths in the entire pandemic.
Yeah. So that piece in a zero tolerance strategy is almost a cornerstone, right? When you get your first case or two, you do everything you can to immediately isolate the pathogen. The United States took much more of a controlled burn. Let's make sure it doesn't overwhelm our acute care system. And so did the closures help in that? I think the answer to that is yes. The question is really the things that are effective were masking and social distancing. And to varying degrees, the closure activities we did were variably effective in terms of their total contribution to getting the effects of masking and isolation. And I think we certainly started to learn where the highest risk opportunities that were worthwhile, even in a relative control burn model, to keep from getting big surges. I think we, over time, did learn which were the instances, the events, the context that led to big super spreader events. And so I think they were useful if you went a zero tolerance approach to the virus. I think it took us as a society a little bit longer to figure out what were the real high risk and to hone in on the things that we needed to shut down.
So is it really infections that drive us to remain in a pandemic, or is it really other factors? For instance, let's be honest, has it always been just about hospital capacity?
I would say predominantly yes.
I would too.
I think we would have been much more accommodating. I think we would have done much more of a let it burn model. I do believe that our country has an acute care capacity problem, and we were unprepared for a challenge or a disaster like this, and that became the resource that defined our behaviors.
I might be a little controversial with this next question, but in over 25 years of being a hospitalist and going through several flu and cold seasons, I've never seen an ICU that wasn't packed or full in my entire career. Is this things that we need to start addressing going into the future?
Well, I think there's two things. One, I want to make sure people know that with COVID, the surges were very different than what we see in a winter surge from the flu. It taxed our healthcare systems like no other infection has in my lifetime. So number one, the surges were much bigger and much harder for our healthcare systems to address. The second thing I was going to say, I think I'll have Marty go into more detail on this, but we do have a shortage of inpatient beds, and we do run at very high capacity across our country in terms of ICU and general medicine beds. And Marty can talk a little more about that.
Here's the thing. When you run something that is as important from a safety perspective, when you run it at nearly full tilt most of the time, or over tilt, right? Most emergency rooms in this country are overflowing with patients. When that's your baseline, you get, and I did a podcast on this, I think, in March of 2020, looking back on my experience with disaster medicine. And I made a statement at that time, and it somewhat played out, which is, if you come into a disaster such that your capacity is already so full, the only way you can get ready for that is to decrease your capacity so that you can be ready for a surge. I use the example of one of my first shifts when I was working as an ER attending, my first shift at a new hospital. I came in and there was a fire in a high-rise building two blocks over. And the first thing we did was cordon off and clear out 15 beds in the emergency room to get ready for these people to come. And in the end, four people with a little bit of smoke inhalation walked into our ER, and then you walked out to our waiting room, and there was just a disaster. People with heart attacks, people with strokes that weren't getting in. We did a little bit of that, right? Which is, we were running ourselves so full that to be able to potentially respond to this surge in inpatients from the pandemic, we had to shut everything else down. And in doing that, we created a secondary disaster. And you see in that in some of the numbers that SG2 is predicting of what we're going to be trying to catch up, deal with, and all the things. There was no screening for colon cancer for nearly a year. Limited screening for breast cancer. All of those things that we do to make sure the population stays on a healthy trajectory, all of those things got compromised in the name of getting ready for this. So it's an unhealthy starting point.
So the Spanish flu had four surges. We've gone through four surges in our country as a whole. Can there still be a variant coming up in the future that's even more lethal?
We don't know. We're in uncertainty right now. And anyone who pretends otherwise is not telling the truth, because we really don't know what will happen with these variants. I have been reading from the scientists that are studying this are saying that it doesn't necessarily mean that we go to milder and milder variants, that there was this body of literature that said that originally, and that's really not the case. In fact, we did see with the Spanish flu that the second year was much worse than the first year. And we've seen with our own variants with COVID that the Delta was much worse than the original Wuhan. So we just don't know.
There is some guidelines or some general concepts that natural selection for viruses tends to prefer things that are more contagious and less pathogenic. Killing your host isn't necessarily right. Ideal for a pathogen. Mutations are random. So that does not preclude mutations that are actually more deadly, but contagious enough to actually become a dominant variant. But there is some natural selection in the other direction. And we've seen that with most of the long-term trajectories with viruses, right?
So let's close by asking, how do you predict we transition towards an endemic state? I think that that's the biggest question that we're having in our country right now.
Once the SARS-CoV-2 becomes stable and predictable. So if we do not get any variants that bypass our immunity, we will see very stable case rates going down over time. If we do get variants, we may see some mini surges, but even we're expecting over time with our medications, our testing, our vaccination efforts and boosting, that we will begin to have higher levels of immunity that will balance out the infection rate of the virus itself.
Yeah, I think it comes back to the question you asked us at the beginning, Tom, which is really this is the constraining variable here, really acute care capacity. And is that really the dominant driver of some of our policies and procedures? And I think we've said yes. And so if you think about it that way, then expediting the transition to an endemic is about doing all of the things that would mitigate getting to a position where you've got acute care demands that create crisis. And the simplest one is really simple. Boosters. Boosters are the single most important component for those that have risk factors and those in the middle age, still working on even in the adolescent population. Boosters are the single most dominant thing we can do to enhance and expedite a transition to endemic. Number two, mature our understanding of timing and efficacy and customization of vaccinations so that we can get to something similar to the flu virus where we have an annual cycle with an identification of relevant strands and doing that. I would say that that's number two. And then I think number three is on the biosurveillance front, getting good at picking up a surge relatively early and making the appropriate adjustments to public health policies and behaviors to respond early with frequent testing. So biosurveillance to understand when you've got population prevalence and individual and frequency and ease of individual testing to determine who in our community are potential spreaders. I think that's the constellation of things that are going to enhance the tempo and the likelihood of us getting to endemic, staying endemic.
Well, that's all the time we have for this episode. I want to thank Matty McDowell and Marty Lucente for joining us. If you'd like to contact them, we'll put their email address on the resource section of our podcast page. And if you have any additional questions pertaining to modern practice or simply want to send us your comments, please contact me at our email, modernpracticepodcast.com. We posted a link in our resource section. And please join us for other Modern Practice Podcasts. Subscribe today, like us, or send us your comments. I'm Dr. Tom Villanueva. Thanks so much for listening.